Freedom News Hour with Walt Thiessen, Jake Town, and Gene DiNardo. Thursdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds.
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here on this Thursday, December 29th, 2011, the last Thursday of the year. And Gene DiNardo is going to be off tonight. Jake Town may be joining me. Not sure just yet if he's going to be joining me, but if he does, we'll connect him in right away. We also have a guest coming on about quarter past the hour. Abby Kisa is a youth coordinator and a research director at CIRCLE. That's the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement. What are they all about? Well, that's one of the nation's leading research centers on youth civic engagement, meaning that they are going to, among other things, be playing a role in determining what happens with the upcoming Iowa caucuses. That's right. Primary season is now nearly upon us because the Iowa caucuses take place this coming Tuesday, January the 3rd, I believe it is. And Abby's going to be talking to us about what she and their organization anticipate is going to be the level of the youth vote and what kind of role it might play in those caucuses. So that's going to be quite interesting. Meanwhile, headlines that are affecting us both here in this country and around the globe. Europe continues to be a problem. The markets responded positively today to both information, domestic and foreign. The foreign information it reacted positively to was the fact that Italy was able to sell roughly $7 billion worth of sovereign debt. They had been aiming for around $8.5 billion with a minimum threshold of about $5.5 billion. So one presumes that they were satisfied to be able to hit the $7 billion threshold. However, the rates on that were over the 7% figure, and that's something that has a lot of analysts concerned. However, there were also some positive housing numbers today, a few other positive economic indicators, so markets responded for the first time in quite some time, really. Commodities are still down a bit. Oil is fluctuating. Gold is down. Silver was up a little bit after being down for three or four or five sessions in a row. And, in fact, I would say both the major precious metals are on their way down in terms of a slow decline. That's going to continue to happen as the European crisis continues to unfold, primarily because the crisis drives people, as their fear kicks into gear, back into the dollar, primarily in the form of treasuries. And we are going to continue to see that happen. The big question, though, in Europe continues to be, how will Italy and the other biggest countries be able to sell their sovereign debt? This is a particularly important problem, not only because of yesterday's sale by Italy, which was a relatively small sale, $7 billion, but because over the next year they've got another 300 billion euros, roughly 411, I think it is, billion dollars, worth of debt that they have to cycle through, debt that's already out there, and they have to renew it. And the question becomes, will they be able to renew it at interest rates that they can afford? It's also very important to note that, despite the fact it doesn't get a lot of attention in the financial press, most of this debt is being bought up by the various banks. It is not being bought up dramatically by the private sector. It's hard to get exact numbers on this, so I can't say exactly how much of it is being bought up by the banks, but it is becoming more and more clear that the banks are the ones who are buying the sovereign debt. And they're buying it with money, of course, that has been created by the central bank. So it is an indirect form of monetary creation that's going on. And how this is going to play out in January, again, it's hard to say, but we do know that there's a major sale coming up of Italian debt. I believe it's the second week of January. Let me see if I can check the information I have on that. Looks like it's around January, let's see, Spain is January 12th. Not sure what the exact date is of the next Italian sovereign debt sale. And Spain is also very much a problematic debt sale. They're expected to sell roughly 25 to 33 billion euros at the January 12th sale. Oh, and here it is. And the Italy sale starts on January 13th. So coming up in the next couple of weeks is going to be a couple of major sales that are going to say a lot about whether or not the European banking system is indeed in as much trouble as the markets have been suggesting. And the markets have been showing it in terms of their unwillingness to stay strong in stocks, to stay strong in commodities, to stay strong in anything other than U.S. dollars and treasury denominations. Also, with the caucuses coming up this coming Tuesday, there's quite a bit of stuff going on in the news. There was the defection from the Bachmann campaign to the Paul campaign of one of Bachmann's top advisors, Iowa State Senator Kent Sorensen, who was the Iowa State chair for the Bachmann campaign, defected to the Paul campaign. There have been a lot of back and forth by the various candidates, as nobody is really a strong, highly leading contender in either Iowa or New Hampshire, which follows quickly after Iowa. So as expected, we're seeing a lot of sniping, a lot of backstabbing and so forth, and I think we'll probably see more of that coming into the caucuses. I think we have our caller on a little bit early. I think Abby's called in. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a short break, and then after the break, we're going to bring her on, and she's going to tell us about what's to be expected at the Iowa caucuses, particularly where the youth turnout is concerned. This is the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we'll be back after these messages. Don't you know you better run, 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 run. Yep, run back, turn up the dial, because we're back here on the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. Well, pacing with you here on Thursday, December 29th, and we have a special guest. Abby Kisa is Youth Coordinator and Research at CIRCLE. That's the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement, one of the nation's leading research centers on youth civic engagement. Over its 10-year existence, CIRCLE has helped build a research field that begun with a public discourse and press coverage about young people as citizens, helped change political campaigns by helping to show that it is cost-effective to mobilize people between the ages of 18 and 30, and has provided training and technical assistance to hundreds of organizations, most directly providers of services to youth. During her 6 years at CIRCLE, Abby has coordinated and led large national research projects focused on both non-college youth and college students. She's also the lead on CIRCLE's work to make sure that their research gets in the hands of practitioners and that this research is informed by on-the-ground realities. So, Abby Kisa, are you on the line?
I am. Thanks so much for having me.
And I hope I pronounced your name correctly. Did I get it right?
You did. And you got CIRCLE right, too, which is impressive.
Oh, good. Well, I try real hard. Well, thank you for joining us. And, of course, as you know, the Iowa caucuses are coming up. That's the signal, so to speak, of the madness of the primary season. And there's been not a whole lot of attention paid to the youth vote, although the Ron Paul campaign has been paying quite a bit of attention. In fact, has been drawing quite a bit of young voters to their rallies. But what's it looking like from your perspective? What do you think is going to be happening in Iowa this coming Tuesday where the people between 18 and 29 are concerned?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of what will actually happen will depend upon a great deal upon whether or not candidates have actually reached out to youth. Young people can play a key role in the caucuses, as they did in 08 when they made up 18% of voters, but it depends a great deal on what the candidates have done to engage young people, to speak directly to young people. Research has shown that when young people are reached out to in a conversational and personal way, that they'll turn out to vote. In 2008, Iowa had the highest rate of youth voter registration since before 1980 at 73%. So Iowa specifically has a strong civic tradition, but I do think it depends a great deal on what candidates have laid the ground for themselves and what will actually happen on the 3rd.
What have you been seeing from your perspective in terms of what the individual campaigns have been doing? Have they been actively reaching out? Has one campaign been stronger than the other? I mean, what are you actually seeing on the ground?
Yeah, well, some of it is hard to follow because they've, you know, been changing up their style a little bit this year. But, you know, you see Ron Paul, like you mentioned, had rallies and had events on campuses, but you haven't heard very much about other candidates doing that. You know, no, I know that there's a a Students for Perry organization, and I know that John Huntsman's daughters are doing as much as they can to draw attention to their father via Twitter especially, but you don't really hear that much about really concerted on-the-ground efforts as much as you do from the Ron Paul campaign.
How do you think that's going to translate? Are young people going to show up at the caucuses? Because traditionally, that age group is not known for being terribly politically active compared to other age groups. So the typical concern is, well, they're not going to show up at all.
Yeah, you know, this is an ongoing story, and I think it's important to point out that, you know, voting is only one form of civic participation, and we follow many forms of it. In 2010, we actually, found and just reported that 3/4 of young people are engaged in some way. You know, young people are boycotting and boycotting things and discussing issues a great deal. But you're right, nationally, youth voting is consistently below that of those who are 30 plus. That said, youth voting nationally has been increasing since 2000. In the 2008 Iowa caucus, in fact, 17 to 24-year-olds turned out at a rate of 15%, while those 30 and older did at a rate of 17%. So it was very close. And in Iowa, it's the second smallest gap between young folks and those who are 30 and older. So I think that, you know, Iowa is a unique place. But again, since there's a small piece of the population that actually participates in the Iowa caucuses, 15%, you know, of youth and 17% in 2008 of those over 30, you know, I think it depends a great deal on, you know, what's bringing those youth and pulling those out and whether or not candidates have really, really connected with them.
Yeah, I can see how that would definitely be a very important factor in it. I would think another factor would be the fact that a fair percentage of this overall age group are people who are continuing in higher education. And in fact, one of the concerns that I have seen written about in a number of different publications online is the concern that those who are currently in college, who are attending one of the Iowa schools, one of either the major universities or the smaller colleges, since they're going to be on break during this time, there's a concern that they may not even try to make the effort to go to the caucuses. What do you think? Is that a viable concern?
Well, it definitely brings up an important question. That said, though, I mean, I keep going back to what the candidates are doing. In 2008, there was a strong showing. I mean, turnout for young people in the 2008 caucus tripled when compared to 2004. So clearly something can be done to build up connections with young people and build up an infrastructure to turn young people out to vote, in January. So I know that, 17 to 24 is a traditional college age, but I also know that when you look at the national population, for example, 50% of young people don't have any college experience. So while we're, and candidates think it's easier to reach out to young people who are on campuses, we also need to talk about, young people who are not on campuses and what can be done to reach out to those folks as well.
Well, that raises an interesting question. I mean, if you were advising a campaign about how to reach this other part of the age group, the part that are not on campuses, what would you say?
Yeah, well, I'd say, we have some groups who we've been working with on exactly this question. And I think it has, at least from what we've seen from our focus groups that we've done on this specific topic, it has a good bit to do a bit with trust and consistency and opportunity. So folks are going to, go to places in their communities that are around, that aren't, kind of just dropping in during campaigns, folks who they trust, who they've seen around their community, around their neighborhood. And also, and that relates to the fact that, some young people who we've spoken with just, don't see opportunities for them to get involved and make a change in their neighborhood or in their state, far be it from nationally. So I think that a lot has to do with, actually having opportunities for young people to use their voice in a way that can better their communities. And one example of how that is not happening is, at the high school level. Civic education in this country has been important for quite a long time and is one of the, you know, kind of core reasons why the public education system was created. But at this point in United States history, there's drastic inequalities in who actually gets civic education opportunities. So your civics classes, your social studies classes, your government classes. And unfortunately, those opportunities fall along class lines as well as racial lines. So young people who are in affluent school districts or who are white are more likely to have those opportunities to learn how to make a difference in their communities.
Yeah, that is a critical thing. And so it raises, again, once again, I guess it reinforces the question, how does a campaign reach out to particularly those groups that are not being connected to through the school system?
Yeah, well, you know, I think that Iowa is a great example of having passed a state law where 17-year-olds who will be 18 by election day can participate in the caucuses. So you can reach young people to participate in civic life even before they're outside of this institution, you know, of education, if they don't, you know, go on to higher ed. So that's one example. The other example is that there's a lot of community-based organizations that specifically, you know, reach out to young people, you know, are a space where young people can hang out, but also get involved in issues that directly affect them and directly affect their communities. So these youth and community organizations are critical. And I've also seen instances where other community agencies that do social services work are, you know, figuring out how to do voter registration and how to activate the people who they work directly with in their community.
Okay. We all know, of course, that the Internet has been expanding by leaps and bounds over the last 10 years. And, of course, the age groups that use it the most are the young people. So the next question has to be about social networking and how that ties into the political cycle. What role is social networking playing this time compared to, say, 4 years ago, compared to, say, 8 years ago? And do you see anything specific happening with social networking where I was concerned?
Where I was concerned, that's a really good question. I mean, one of the exciting things, in my view, that's happened with the debates so far is that they've been multifaceted. So you can, you know, you can watch online, you can watch on television, you know, if you have cable, or you can follow, you know, for example, on Twitter. So I think that that's one unique way for young people to feel like they're participating in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, when you have a campaign, you know, that has a Twitter feed or a campaign that's active on Facebook, you know, just as two examples, it makes someone feel like they're, you know, kind of more a part of something. But at the same time, you know, one of the things that we saw in the 2008 campaign is that, you know, these new technologies can open up ways for someone to participate and contribute as well, where you can get call sheets to help do GOTV work. Even if you're, you know, not in Des Moines, you might be able to call voters in Des Moines because you've signed up for getting a voter list on a campaign website, for example.
Sure.
So I think that they're exciting in opening up the ways in which young people can participate and have a conversation.
Do you have any way of measuring how much that was used for GOTV in 2008?
Actually, no, that's a great question, but I don't specifically have that data.
That would be really interesting to know, and to not only compare 2008 to past years, but also compare to what's likely to happen in 2012, because the explosion of social media has just been really quite remarkable. In fact, we saw it this past year in 2011 with the Arab Spring and so forth, and Occupy Wall Street.
Absolutely. And one thing that, you know, we know from research, from, you know, civic research, is that if someone talks about an election, they're more likely to vote in it. So you could look at websites like Facebook or tools like Twitter as opportunities to discuss an election. Now, there needs to be a whole lot more research done on these things, but if we look at them in those ways, you could say that, you know, people are having conversations about elections on Facebook, so that might make them more likely to vote in that election.
It's an interesting question. I was actually a political science major many years ago when I was in college. We won't say how many, but but when I was in college, I was a political science major, and at that time, I don't know exactly how political science is taught these days, but at the time, it was very statistically oriented and very much involved with surveys and so forth. And one of the things that you were always trying to do was to make sure that you didn't overstate what your surveys were actually telling you, and it didn't try to draw too much too many conclusions from the data. But with the amount of data that is now currently being put together where social media is concerned, I think there's actually almost a danger that virtually any conclusion you draw could be an overconclusion simply because the data is so amorphous. It comes from so many different sources. It is not participating. It's sort of it's a society-wide, I don't know, a mass movement, if you will. That's probably the wrong way of describing it. But because of that, any kind of data that we apply to this scenario is going to be really hard to take scientifically as being a true representation of what's going on. That I guess what I'm trying to get at is, even if we have numbers, it's hard to quantify, and not only that, it's hard to conclude from the quantification what you actually know.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. When I see a poll or I see anything else, first thing I do is look at the methodology. Who did they talk to? When did they talk to them? How many young people are in that sample? That's the first thing us geeky folks do. But on that point, I actually think, you know, it'll be very interesting and important to see what happens in 2012 as a whole, and if the dynamics like Occupy Wall Street, like, you know, the Tea Party's surge, things like Americans Elect or issue-based movements like the environment, and, you know, how and whether or not that can be translated into voting. And, you know, as a result, we have to interpret the results of the election carefully, because, you know, if those people are mobilized and the person who they choose is, you know, for example, Barack Obama, we're not necessarily, you know, sure whether or not that's because they really like him or that's because, you know, he just happened to have more, you know, kind of issue-based views similar to that young person. Because I know a lot of people are interested in this question of, you know, whether or not young folks are still as supportive of the president. And so I think it'll be interesting to try to, you know, tease out what exactly is happening, and we have to be careful not to overgeneralize. I agree with you.
Yeah, and actually you're kind of starting to touch on what was the main theme of 2008 and what's likely to be a sort of a counter theme for the same reason in 2012, and that is, in 2008 it was all about change. It was rather an undefined change, but it was about change, and President Obama, at that point, candidate Obama, was identified with change. Since then, there's been obviously, there's been nearly 4 years of his presidency. There's been a lot of disappointment. There's been some people still in support, but there's been a lot of I guess what I might call a kickback, or I'm trying to draw the term from what the CIA uses, blowback, regarding that whole change thing. So how is change going to play out in 2012? How is it going to show up as a campaign theme? Is it going to show up as a negative campaign theme? There wasn't any real change, so we got to have real change, or is it going to be more along the lines of continue the change with President Obama?
Yeah, I mean, that's the question of the hour of the year, isn't it?
It really is.
We'll be tracking that as closely as we can, even though that's a pretty qualitative dynamic. I mean, one of the things that I just want to, you know, kind of reiterate is the fact that, you know, young people participate in so many different ways. So, you know, on top of the fact that, you know, we should really look at many different, you know, kind of indicators of young people being engaged besides voting, we should also look at, you know, young people in different in their different groups, because young people participate very differently.
Go through a few of those, because that actually is a good point and probably doesn't get enough coverage.
Which one?
The fact that young people in particular are engaged in a variety of different ways, and that voting may be only one expression of the ways that they're involved. What are some of those other ways that they engage?
Yeah, so you see, you know, young people, you know, there's been a lot of structures that have been built up over the past, you know, 20-some years to facilitate young people getting involved in their local communities through volunteering and community service. You know, there's requirements at the high school level often. Maryland has a state requirement for service learning. But there are also, you know, for those who are lucky enough to go to college, there are a lot of centers for civic engagement, centers for service learning that have built up over the past 25 years. So volunteering is big. The other thing is that, you know, there's a lot of discussion going on, and there's a lot of communication about civic and political issues over the internet. You know, so I think that we have to, you know, kind of talk a little bit holistically about the kind of life that young people are living, and how and in what ways and in which venues they're being sort of pulled into community issues and opportunities to participate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's always the question. The thought that comes to my mind now, again, I haven't been near a college campus in, 50 years, something like that. It's been a while. Maybe not 50, but it's been a while since I've been on campus. And as a result, I mean, put it this way, when I was in school, we didn't have PCs. PCs were not quite there yet. So the whole dynamic on campus has changed dramatically. And that's really where this next question is coming from. I realize that these various organizations have been developing these organizations that are designed to involve people more in civic type activities. But truly, how successful have they been? How many people are they actually drawing out of these college communities to actually be directly involved? Is it a small percentage? Is it a large percentage? A fair percentage? How would you characterize it?
Well, I think it depends a good bit on which campus you're talking about.
Okay.
Some campuses have, a culture and an ethos of engagement on their campuses. And so their mottos, for example, Princeton's motto is all about public service, just as one example. And other campuses have that kind of ethos as well. So, some things are just culturally everywhere on campus. When on other places, it's not quite exactly the same. But at the same time, you have thousands of students on campuses getting involved, doing hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions of hours of local community service, and that's only through one particular office. Not to mention all of the student organizations. So no, not every single college student is involved, but there's been a significant movement on college campuses to, embed this idea of civic engagement into the curriculum and into the culture of campus and many places.
And where do you think the major areas of civic engagement actually turn out to be? In other words, what do the students actually end up focusing on?
Yeah, well, that's one of the, I think, tensions about this particular work, is that work has primarily focused on local engagement. So it's focused on working with local community-based organizations.
And, Jazz, give us some examples.
Yeah, so examples like, Big Brothers, Big Sisters,
okay.
Or, a local soup kitchen, tutoring, stuff like that. There's a lot of partnerships between higher education institutions and local schools for tutoring and mentoring. But I think that brings up, that's a great point, how how do higher ed institutions provide students with a range of strategies for how they can make their mark in the world and make a difference? And, and to me, and based on what I've seen, that there's a ways to go for higher ed to figure out how they can engage young people in even nonpartisan political engagement.
Okay. Now, I would think also that in part because of what we talked about earlier, the nature of the fact that we're currently in an internet-driven society, I would think there would also be sort of grassroots-type activities, stuff that just springs up here or there where students decide to, on their own, to go out and engage on something. Am I wrong about that, or is that something that actually happens? I mean, it strikes me as being, that would be what would be behind, say, the Arab Spring over across the ocean. I would think similar kinds of things would be happening here. I guess perhaps the best example being Occupy Wall Street.
Yeah, for sure. And, for exactly, the point that you were bringing up earlier, sometimes those things are really hard to track. So,
yeah.
So a researcher might not have their, fingers on, particular statistics related to that. But yes, there are so many organizations in local communities and nationally who are doing amazing, important work reaching out to young people and helping them develop their civic and political capacities. And some of that stuff is really, under the radar of major institutions.
And under the radar in the sense that it's not being noticed, or under the radar in the sense that it's a bunch of small little activities that kind of add up to a larger total?
I think it could be both.
Right.
It could be both.
Okay. Well, very interesting. I'm going to take us back very briefly to the Iowa caucuses. I'm going to kind of put you on the spot here. You mentioned before, I think it was 15% participation rate in the 2008 caucuses. What do you think is going to happen this year?
Yeah, well, I think that one really important thing to point out is that with respect to who young people choose in the Iowa caucuses, it is a very small amount of young people in Iowa For example, in 2012, just 5,000 young voters could be enough to win the youth vote in the Iowa caucuses in 2012.
Wow.
But there are about, you know, just over 500,000 17 to 29-year-old citizens in Iowa. 12,000 youth participated in the 2008 Republican caucuses. You know, so 5,000 could win the youth vote. So it means that, you know, depending upon what candidates have done to reach out to young people, you know, just 1% of the youth population could mean, in Iowa, could mean that, you know, any ideological or identity group could, you know, prevail if they were motivated by a campaign or a candidate to turn out.
It's a really interesting point because typically the Iowa caucuses are a relatively small turnout thing. I think it's somewhere around 100,000 people typically go to them. And when you look at it that way and you realize, like you said, what the numbers are of overall young people, wow, I mean, if somebody were to really mobilize young people, they could practically take over the caucuses, couldn't they?
Yes. They'd have to have the infrastructure and the ground game.
Right,
to it.
Right. But nevertheless, I mean, the potential there is kind of staggering when you think about it. Of course, also there's the logistics of actually pulling it off. It's not just because we pose the excitement of, wow, what if all those young people showed up, doesn't mean that you can easily just go out and do it. There's a huge job involved in getting them out, isn't it?
Yeah, but, you know, one of the things that research has shown quite a bit on a variety of forms of civic engagement is that if young people are asked to participate, they're way more likely to do so.
Just the simple act of asking them.
Yeah, simple act of doing that. So if a candidate in a campaign, you know, reaches out to young people and says, hey, can you help me? You know, if they believe in what they're doing, then, you know, and they're asked to do real work for a campaign, mm-hmm. I can see, you know, that really, you know, having a big impact.
Well, I guess we'll have to wait and see what happens next Tuesday. Of course, following Iowa is New Hampshire and then South Carolina, and those are regular primaries. They aren't caucuses, so they're much more subject to the trends of the overall population. What do you see happening with the youth vote in New Hampshire and South Carolina?
I think it's a really similar question of what candidates have been doing and whether or not they've actually, you know, kind of invested in reaching out to young people. I know that that's been a little bit monotonous with that, but I think that, you know, especially with these, you know, small numbers that participate in primaries and caucuses, that's really what it's about.
I suppose it's true for the entire population, no matter how you slice that. It just strikes me as a particularly interesting question where the youth are concerned, just because of what we talked about at the top of this interview, and that was the fact that youth typically don't tend to show up as much as their peers in other age groups. So it makes you wonder, is this going to be a change this year? Is this going to be something where, because of the social media, because of all the activity, interactivity, the invitations to participate in civic affairs and so forth, is that going to actually change the dynamic where the youth vote is concerned?
It certainly can help people if they leverage it in an effective and targeted way. You know, there's no, you know, as so many people have said, there's no, you know, miracle, there's no silver bullet website or application.
What?
You gotta
there
figure
isn't
out
a silver
what
bullet? What's wrong? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, I think so. You got to use it smart, and you got to use it in a way that can, you know, be in addition to what's going on the ground. You know, the online tools are just that. They're tools. They're not, you know, an end in and of itself.
Well, very good. Well, my colleague Jake Town has been able to join us. Jake, are you on the phone?
Yes, I am. How's
it
going?
Hey, Jake. Welcome to the show this week. And Jake, meet Abby. Abby, I don't know how much you caught of the interview so far, but Abby is the youth coordinator and researcher at CIRCLE. That's the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement. And she and I have been having quite a conversation here, among other things, about what's likely to happen in Iowa this coming week, particularly where the youth vote is concerned. She's had some very interesting insights. I don't know how much of that you caught, but if you did catch any of it, did you have any questions for her?
No, I just got online, so I just...
You just got in. Okay, so you missed all the good stuff. Jake, that'll teach you for showing up late, I tell you. Well, Abby, I think at this point, then, I will wrap up our interview, but I want to... I'm going to try to pin you down. I tried twice now, and it didn't work, but I'm going to try one more time. What do you think is going to happen on Tuesday in Iowa?
With respect to the youth vote, I think that we'll see, we'll see what candidates have done to reach out. You know, we've seen over the past, in I believe it was 96 and in 2008, there was about 12,000 young people who participated in the GOP caucuses. So I wouldn't be surprised if it was a really similar number, unless candidates have really, you know, got their ground game connected to their online game and really connected with young people.
Okay, very good. And Abby, what's the website for your organization?
All of our research is online at civicyouth.org.
Civicyouth.org. And is there any social media? If we have young people listening, maybe they'll want to connect in through social media.
Absolutely. We are really active on Twitter at civicyouth, and we're on facebook.com/civicyouth.
All right. Very good. Abby Kisa from Circle, thanks so much for joining us here today on the Freedom News Hour.
Thanks again for having me.
And we're going to take a short break. Afterward, Jake and I are going to go back to the headlines and take us through to the top of the hour. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network. We will be right back. Yeah, run back to your dial. We're back here on the Freedom News Hour. And, Jake, let's go to you and talk a little bit about what's going on with the lobbying efforts that are going on in Congress, because it's making a particular impact on income taxes, isn't it?
Yes, well, a recent study that came out by an organization known as publiccampaign.org published a study that has 30 of the leading U.S. corporations, how they've paid more money to lobby Congress than income taxes over 2008 through 2010. The list includes companies such as General Electric, Verizon, Wells Fargo, Con Edison, Boeing, DuPont, Honeywell International, and Mattel, Corning, and FedEx. So those are the types of companies. And this is an aggregate number, so it might be a little bit tricky, but like, for instance, General Electric has over, from 2008 through 2010, reported $10 billion in profits. But they, through the system of tax rebates that they had, they actually got money back from the government of -$4.7 billion. So they've had a negative flow, really. The government's basically giving them money to cover either past accounting loopholes or whatever. They don't actually give the real details.
Now these are the 30 largest corporations. Is that what it is?
No, it's just 30 major.
30 major,
not 30,
okay.
The largest. But General Electric has spent $84 million on lobbying over those same 3 years. In terms of getting these perks back, they are, you know, it kind of pays for them to lobby Congress. And the 30 corporations that they used here added up approaches about $400,000 every day, including weekends, over this three-year period to lobby lawmakers and influence political elections. They've spent about $22 million on federal campaigns, and the group as a whole, the 30 companies, accumulated profits of $164 billion. But their combined, and again, it's a selected group, but their combined tax rebates came back. They got $11 billion out of the federal government. So they're basically getting paid by the government because they help write the laws, and they also happen to be the firms that lobby the most. So it's kind of fascinating the way, this whole crony capitalism or crony socialism works.
Well, it's fascinating. It's one word. Another word might be corrupt. But before we even go there, I think you may have mentioned it, but I wanted to go back to it. What are the names of some of these corporations? Who are some of these corporations that are basically getting a lot more out of it than they're putting into it?
Well, the largest one is General Electric.
Right.
We've got, $4.7 billion back. Verizon Communications had profits of $32 billion and received tax rebates back of close to $1 billion.
Mm-hmm.
They spent $52 million on lobbying.
Wow.
Wells Fargo, one of our nice little fractional reserve banks bailed out by the government, they reported $49 billion in profits. but they paid, you know, they're not paying any taxes on those profits. They actually got back $700 million, and they've spent $11 million lobbying. So if you take a look at even just the taxes of the rebates that they get back, like Wells Fargo, they spent $11 million to lobby, which, you know, sounds a lot, can influence a lot of elections and that sort of thing. But it pays off for them because, you know, they're getting money back from the federal government of $700 million in rebates. Some of the other
Are there other banks on the list? I guess that's what I was wondering.
I'm going through the list right now. General Electric, of course, is also kind of a quasi-bank, but it doesn't appear like they have any other banks on this list. A lot of them are from the energy or communications, some in manufacturing.
Right, okay. So as you mentioned, GE Capital is a rather major financial situation, but they're not actually a bank per se. I was wondering about banks, and so that's why I was pushing you down that road. But interesting story nonetheless, and a little bit disturbing, not terribly surprising, I suppose, but to actually hear names attached to, you know, names of companies we recognize attached to that list, that's very, you know, educational and informative.
Right, and again, I've read through what they put together, and I think it might be slightly, some of it might actually be slightly biased because they don't share all the data. Because again, like a corporation might be reporting a major gain one year and then a major loss the next year.
Right.
And some of these things might kind of cancel out. But, you know, just the fact that these 30 companies, and not all of them are huge names, just these 30 companies are spending $400,000 every day. That in itself, like I said, kind of is a real eye-opener, because in the face of just that money from these 30 companies, and again, there's quite a few more larger name corporations and banks that are lobbying, it is kind of not really any surprise that Congress ends up representing the special interests rather than the people, because again, the people, yeah, you get to have your own voice, but you get to have a voice, you know, in election, you know, on the federal level, every couple years or so.
Yeah, one out of 300 million, too.
Right, and meanwhile, these corporations and special interests, they get their voice pretty much every day.
Yeah, and that really is a key point. It's almost discouraging that they're not getting as much attention, particularly in the Republican primaries, which I guess is not terribly surprising considering what that party is about. But except for some things that Ron Paul has said, really the corporations are not getting hardly any attention at all. And I guess that's why I let off with that article after the interview, because considering all of the backstabbing and the accusations and counter-accusations that have gone on, particularly in the last few days where Iowa's concerned, it's just kind of striking that this doesn't even come up, does it?
Yeah. I would say that Ron Paul and some of them do bring up these issues. But it's kind of like something by the wayside, and I think what you'll see is probably more of that in the general election.
Perhaps, so we can hope for that. I guess when you're in the primary season, you're basically trying to appeal to one political base, so maybe you're not likely to get to it as much. Meanwhile, we've got other things going on, and in fact, you had something that I wasn't even aware of. Apparently, there is a new deal between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia for some F-15s.
Right, this just came out. We have the military, our government, and signed an agreement with Saudi Arabia to sell nearly $30 billion worth of F-15 fighter jets.
Wow.
So this was, again, announced while Iran is carrying out military war games and what have you in the Persian Gulf. Calls for the production of 84 new F-15SA aircraft and the modernization of Saudi Arabia's current fleet of 70 F-15s, along with, quote, munitions, spare parts, training, maintenance, and logistics, unquote.
This has got to be in response to Iran's, not so much a threat, but an implied threat that they could close down the Strait of Hormuz. I mean, just the timing of it just seems terribly opportune.
Oh, sure. I guess the common thread between the two news items I just listed here is Boeing. Boeing was part of that 30 major
corporations. Oh, they were?
Yes. Boeing reported about $10 billion in profits over the last, from 2008 through 2010, and got tax rebates of close to $200 million. And meanwhile, they are probably actually the largest spender on this list that they have, or no, besides GE. They spent $52 million lobbying over those same 3 years.
Wow.
And again, you know, Boeing primarily aircraft, but also pretty much it's a defense contractor as well. There's kind of really no reason that one can think of as to what they'd be getting the net rebate back from the government except for this type of lobbying stuff.
Well, also because of the way the tax code is written. I mean, the corporate tax system is kind of a mess anyway. But when you take into account all the different ways that they can deduct, I mean, it becomes almost amazing that you don't have more corporations who are in the same kind of situation that these 30 are.
Right.
Something else going on. This is something that just came out. I believe it came out today. News about the latest regarding mortgage signings, and of course, that's been a big portion of what's happening and what's likely to happen where the economy is concerned, because home sales have been down, prices are continuing to drop, mortgages have not been signed in any large amounts, but they did increase over the year and a half leading to November. Apparently, there is an increase of around 7.3%, which is a pretty healthy increase. However, there is a caveat associated with this increase. The caveat is that the number of Americans signing to contracts while they're signing contracts to buy homes at their highest rate in a year and a half. The problem is that many of them are walking away from the contracts. It turns out that contract signings often, particularly in this economy, lead to the contracts falling apart a month or two later. So these numbers are a little bit misleading. So it makes me wonder. The market was reacting to this, among other things, today. It was up today for the first time in a while, in part because of this report. But how long are the numbers going to hold together? Because there's often a 1 to 2 month lag between when there's a signing and when there's a closing. And during that time, that's when a lot of these contracts are apparently falling apart. What rate are they falling apart? It's hard to get exact numbers, but what we do know is that a third of realtors had at least one contract scuttled in November and October, which is up from 18% in September. So while we don't know exact numbers, it looks like they are increasing at a rather, you know, substantial rate, perhaps not exponential. So more good slash bad news coming in the mortgage market.
Yeah, the murky mortgage market.
Murky, yeah, that's a good way to describe it, especially with what is not yet resolved where Roe was signing and the foreclosure situation is concerned, and with continued suggestions that foreclosures are going to take off again in 2012. Also, news coming out of China, both sides of the equation where gold is concerned and precious metals, but also there is more information going on about China and Japan where the trade of currencies is concerned. What are the details on that?
Yes, over kind of like the quiet of the Christmas holiday here in the United States, China and Japan have signed a deal to back the direct trade of their currencies, the Chinese yuan and the Japanese yen. This will, of course, is dollar negative over the long term. China is Japan's biggest trading partner with about $340 billion in U.S. dollars in two-way transactions last year. The pact between the world's second and third largest economies mirror attempts by fund managers to diversify as the two-year-old European debt crisis keeps global financial markets volatile and on their toes. Previously, about 60% of the trade between the two countries was done in dollars. So, again, what happens when this finally goes through, that 60% or that, let's see, that would be roughly $200 billion are going to need some other place to go other than the countries, because they'll just be trading directly in their own currencies, which are all of them are paper currencies. But, you know, as we've talked about here on the show, the dollar serves as the world's reserve currency. And when you have more and more countries giving up on the dollar and having these dollars kind of not really have any home, what you're eventually going to see is dollar-denominated assets are going to rise in price. That's what we're going to see, you know, here at home. We see it in inflation, but the Federal Reserve typically exports a lot of its inflation to other countries in the world as all the other currencies debase themselves as well. But with this type of thing going on, we may see more inflation domestically than is seen internationally by holders of dollars.
Yeah, I think that's true. And plus, there's a backdrop going on here in China on both sides of the coin where gold is concerned. On the one hand, there is a person who is a senior central bank official. His name is Zhang Xianhua. I probably pronounced that really badly, but he's the director of research affiliated with the People's Bank of China, and he said the Chinese government should not only be cautious of the imported risk caused by rising global inflation, but also further optimize its foreign exchange portfolio and purchase gold assets when the gold price shows a favorable fluctuation. It's an interesting comment from a Chinese central bank banker. In addition to that, and this is something we touched on in previous shows over the last few months, China is now clamping down on these private gold exchanges that have cropped up around the country. They're basically saying no local authority, institution, or individual is allowed to set up gold exchanges. That's from a notice dated December 20th and jointly issued by the People's Bank of China, the Ministry of Public Security, and other regulators. The notice is basically designed to shut down these independent exchange platforms that have cropped up and have been doing quite a bit of business. So this could really signal something very serious where China's concerned in precious metals. Well, I think we're at the end of the hour here, but Jake, I'm glad you were able to join us for the last part, and even though we had you on for only a short time, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, sorry it was late, everyone, and stay free.
All right, we'll see you all next week here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.